Yeah, the subject that we're going to be discussing is the issue of telling the truth. You could frame it in the question, is a person, we know that a person is obligated to tell the truth, but is that true in every situation? And what is the attitude of the Torah towards the question of lying, fibbing, and so on and so forth? That's a very significant thing. Now, most people will tell you that it's wrong to lie. I think most people are involved in somewhat of a contradiction, and that is that it's not an absolute. Most people who would get very upset about somebody, that's a big issue in politics. In many situations, for example, the whole issue, we're not going to dredge up the whole issue of President Clinton and the scandal, but many people weren't concerned about the sexual aspect of it, but rather the lie. That becomes even worse than the deed itself, which I find a little bit difficult to understand, because once a person engages in certain types of behaviors that obviously he doesn't want to publicize, so what choice does he have? Of course, the person is going to lie. Cover up. That's what brought Nixon down, was the cover up. That's an offense. People take umbrage. The crime itself may have been small, but the cover up, that's much worse in many people's minds. It's a good thing to bear in mind. However, I think that people that generally get outraged, how terrible the lie is, I think most people are really involved in a contradiction. If they were to be totally honest, then they would acknowledge that it depends when and where, because I think that everybody engages in lying. Well, most people would engage, unless they work on it. Obviously, see, the Torah, as I've mentioned many times, there's no such thing as of a person being naturally perfected. And people cling to this idea. They think that they're good people. I'm good by nature. I don't lie. I tell the truth. People make these kinds of statements, but when you analyze it and break it down, look at, for example, when they have to get out of something that they don't want to do. Well, there's a telephone call, and there's a very important moment in the TV program right now. It's just not a good time to call. But you can't tell that to the one who's calling. So you tell your kid, whoever answers the phone, you tell them, you know, mommy's busy right now. I'm in this boat, whatever it is. You make up something. So everybody utilizes these kinds of things. You're getting out of an appointment. You had been invited for a meal on jobs. I think most people will acknowledge, as I was beginning to say, that if you have an appointment for Shabbos or something else, you know, you've already committed, and something else comes up which you would much prefer to do. Well, there's a way out. It's true that there's a way out, because you can fess up. Interesting. But let's say you don't want to fess up because you know the other person is going to be hurt. If it's a case where you have an opportunity to be with somebody else, no matter what it is, and if you tell the truth and have to break the luncheon appointment, then this person's going to be hurt. They may not acknowledge that they're hurt. That's an issue that they have. People don't want to acknowledge it. So you understand that, and therefore you have to make up an excuse. Well, everybody lies. Who tells the truth when you're stopped by a cop on the road? I went through the stop sign. You're 100% correct. I deserved the ticket. That's very rare. It's a good strategy. Because you disarm the person. Yeah, people that do tell the truth in those situations are telling the truth. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that. And the strategy, the psychology is that sometimes it'll work, that the person will respect you for at least owning up to it and won't give you the ticket. But that's not the natural reaction. The natural reaction is denial. Denial? Didn't do it. And so on and so forth. And if you are clever enough to work at some kind of excuse, you were on your way to an important appointment, and that's why you were distracted, and whatever the case may be, and you really get the officer, and he doesn't give you, you took your way out of something, so then that's a hit. People are bragging about that all the time. It's genius, like a genius. He took his way out of that situation. In fact, that's what lawyers do all the time. Most of them, it's really distorting the situation to fake a jury out. And that's considered to be a respected thing in our society. It's an ideal to get in front of a jury, take the set of facts, and so, which is pretty obvious, the O.J. Simpson trial, and convince a jury, whatever, that it didn't happen. The whole thing was a conspiracy. So these people are geniuses, and they're rewarded for their ability to lie. That's the problem. It's the problem that you face as a Jew living in a society which rewards that type of behavior. It's interesting. I just had a big discussion with my students. I'll mention it to you, mainly with my women's students and my women's school. I spoke, it's something that happened, you know, my students share their experiences. With regard to a very simple kind of a thing, trivial, it's going to be trivial. I'll say, what's the big deal? It's very trivial. It's very trivial. But the question is, does it make any difference when it comes to lying if something is very important or something is trivial? Now, you all agree that it does make a difference, that you're allowed to lie on trivial things. Most people believe that. It's trivial. Who cares? What's the difference? Yeah, but if it's an ethical thing and it really affects your soul in terms of your relationship with God, so what difference? What difference does it make? Anyways, this fellow told me that it concerns a date. He was set up with a girl. He had never met her. And she was in from Israel, actually. American. The family had gone there years ago. She grew up most of her life in Israel, but essentially or originally she was American. Not that it's relevant to the story, but I'm just setting it up. So she came into the States, and she was going on dates, shidduchim. So he called her up, as I remember it, I don't remember all the particulars, and going through the schedule, he had either Tuesday or Wednesday was good for him. Okay? So she, Tuesday's very good. And this was Monday, he made the phone call on Monday, and they set a date for Tuesday. And then Tuesday, she calls him up, and she breaks it. Something came up, and I can't make it. But she didn't want to miss out on the opportunity, so she said that. But Wednesday would be fine. So she managed to lock in Wednesday to make that change. And then he, you know, was kind of caught by surprise, and you know, he didn't feel like challenging her or what came up, and so on and so forth. You know, he just hung up, the conversation ended, but he said it was bothering him afterwards, and he asked me what I thought. And I said, nothing comes up. Things don't just come up in life. That's not the way it works. It doesn't happen. Obviously, I recommend, I don't think that you have to not, you know, go on the date with her because of this. I don't think it's, but it's wrong. What she did is wrong. Because, and that's why you feel hurt. She disrespected you. The word in our society is she dissed you. Because, what do you mean? You make a date, that's a commitment. You made a commitment, and you base your plan on it, and so on and so forth. If you're going to say that you make a date, and you could just call up and say, I'm not coming, so then there's no date. And it's wrong. It's false. It's false because you made a commitment. Doesn't mean to say that that it's written in stone, that you can't break a date. But then you have to fess up. You have to say such as, I said, it could be. It's possible that she had another date. That she was holding in abeyance, and then that's possible. But don't take it personally because she doesn't even know you, so it can't be an insult to you personally. Could be that there's some other person, can't make it any other time, and now she found out about it, and she wants to get that date also. I said it also could be that she's got friends in America, and they want to get together with her, and this is the only time they can get together with her, and she doesn't want to miss that, and she doesn't want to miss the date either. There's plenty of things that could have come up. But she's wrong. In my opinion, she was wrong. Because that's not being truthful. You should have been honest and said, this is what happened. And you asked the other person. Now, you asked the other person, is it okay with you? You don't just break the date. You need, unless, obviously, if we're talking about something that's serious, if there's illness, there's certain situations where you don't need the other person's permission. It's obvious. It's understood. I mean, it's the rules of the game. But I got a lot of flack on this from the girls. At first they thought, what's the big deal? You know, so she's going out the next day. What's the problem? Practically speaking. So we had a very serious dialogue, discussion, up and back. I maintain that this is an injustice. Now, the whole thing may sound very trivial, and I'm like, that's true, because I recommended that you go out anyways, and don't make a big deal out of it. You can make a comment like, I hope there's nobody ill in the family. You know, something like that. A few choice comments. But I told him not to do that because if you should have asked at the time. You should have confronted her. Now that now forget about it. Be the big guy and don't show that you're going to get petty about it. But I maintain that in that type of a situation, you sort of you sort of owe something to the other person, because you made a commitment, as I said before. And once the other person agrees, there's an agreement that you have between you. And this agreement, you're basing, you're going to make plans, you're going to cancel other events, and so on and so forth. So within the parameters, I think you have an obligation to keep it. Now, it was very tough to get this point across to the girls. Until I asked them point blank, you know, we're pretty honest with each other. Let's say it happened to you. Let's say somebody made a date and just called you up and said, something came up, can't make it. Would it bother you? And then, very, very reluctantly, they admitted it would bother them. But they said, but the guys are different. It doesn't bother guys that much. That's really what they said. These are very high-level people. I'm serious. They study on a very advanced level. I said, what? You're saying you have a right, in terms of dealing with other people, to determine the extent of how much it hurts the other person? And if I feel that it doesn't hurt the other person as much as it hurts me, I'm permitted to do it? What kind of... They said the general rule is, whenever you're in doubt about doing something, will it hurt somebody else? A good rule is, put yourself in that position. Imagine if it was done to you. And if you say, but I wouldn't mind, yeah, but if you wouldn't mind because you've really worked on the emotion a lot, that's not a good sign. Then you can't do it, because maybe the other person hasn't worked on that emotion. But just go by your automatic emotional reaction. Is this the kind of thing that would bother you? Yes. Everybody would be bothered. If somebody breaks a date with you, and even an appointment with you, in most cases, it's going to bother you. What happened? Did I say something wrong? So that's the point I wanted to make. But I do think that this reflects the fact that people, while in general they condemn lying, everybody condemns lying, I think everybody in their own mind believes that there are certain lies that are permitted. And this is an area which I think is very, very important, and one has to be very, very careful, because in doing this, it's sending a bad message to children, especially. Whenever you utilize, so to speak, the services of the children to tell a lie, telling the kid what on the phone, you make up a story why you can't come to the phone, or you're bragging how you were stopped by a policeman and how you talked your way out of it with some lies, which is things that are not true. When that takes place, you're sort of sending a message, you're contradicting, because the kid is going to school learning that it's not supposed to lie, and you get very angry at the children if they lie to you. Pay it to see. However, in reality, the real message seems to be that under certain circumstances, it's an admirable kind of an ability, to smooth things over and to get out of things by manipulating the truth. Now, the Torah takes a very strong stance against this. The Torah, in a sense, I would say that lying is pretty much of an absolute. But there are exceptions, as we're going to learn. And we should appreciate the importance. It's not enough, I mean, just to give you a guilt trip and without understanding. The reason why lying... And lying under virtually any circumstances is a very serious thing. The Torah says, "Midvar sheker tirchak." It doesn't say that you shouldn't lie. It says, from something which is false, tirchak, you should maintain a distance. You should keep far, far away from things that are false. It's because in Judaism, I think that this is unique. The whole basis of a person's relationship with God, it's all based upon emes, Hashem Elokeichem emes, to emulate the ways of God. And the essence of God is that this is truth, that we're all searching for the truth. And we all have powerful emotions, and very often there's conflicts, and when we have these conflicts, it takes us away from the truth, and when it takes you away from the truth, and you engage in a lie, it corresponds, there is a certain emotional desire for a person to be able to manipulate reality through the power of his words. There is such a thing. And your training, the more you get involved in lying, the more you're training yourself to be able to deal with reality through manipulation, the further it takes you from truth. It takes you away from God. It's not just a social phenomenon that you're hurting other people by lying, but it's in terms of your relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, in terms of your perfection. So, for example, if you go through the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah, in Deos, in Hilchos Deos, I recommend everybody should read this. I don't know what it would do to social life. It would slow social life down a lot. The Rambam extols the virtue of shesikah, of silence. He says there's nothing more healthy, he says, even for the body. He quotes from Pirkei Avos. Lo matzasi laguf tov mishesikah. that I haven't found something which is healthier. Which means to say that, I've used this expression, perhaps I've said it here, is that one of a person's greatest enemies, I think we'll all agree, in this existence, is his own mouth. That's one of the person's biggest enemies. How often do we get ourselves into unnecessary trouble because we only kept quiet? But there's this need to talk, and the more you talk, the more the instinctual elements come out and you say things. That's what the Rambam says, that a person should be marbe b'shisika, should engage a great deal in silence. And this is what he says, should not, obviously what we're talking about over here is very high ideal. And a person has to be realistic about applying it. You can't just go cold turkey. And we don't have these monasteries where people take a vow of silence and don't talk for 35 years. We don't have that concept. Not Jews. Jews don't have that thing. But at least we should begin. We should begin to practice of silence at least in one small segment of our lives. How about during davening? We should. That's a good place to start, to practice silence. I'll have to mention it again on Shabbos. He says a person should not speak, except for Dvar Chachma, to communicate, because that's what speech was given, to communicate knowledge. Oh, b'dvarim shetzarech lehem l'chayei gufo. Well, for things that are necessary for his physical existence, realistically. So basically, speech should have a purpose, a function. And they said about Rav, who was a student of Rabbeinu, Rav Yehuda HaNasi, who was the author of the Mishnah, Shelo Sach Sicha B'Tela Kol Yomav, that he didn't speak a B'Tela. Sicha B'Tela means chatter, idle chatter, all of his life. But he says that this is the Sicha of most people, Rov B'nei Adam. Idle chatter is what, if a person were to review at the end of the day, if a person would go on a tape recorder the whole time and tape all of your talk, your conversation, I think one could learn a great deal of how much energy and time is being wasted, and not to one's advantage or anyone's advantage. Then he says, whoever engages in too much speech, this brings about, leads to sin. This is, and then he says, they said that I have not found something better for the body than silence. And he goes even so far, even in Divrei Torah, in Divrei Chachma. Now he's going further. He's saying even when it comes to study of Torah, you shouldn't be excessive in words. That the words should be less, but the significance should be, speak less, but the significance of what you're saying should be more, as opposed to people that just go on and on and on and on. And this is the famous advice of the Chachamim, that a person, la'olam yashne adam l'talmidav derech tzara, that a person should teach the students with brevity. Less words. That's an interesting thing. I remember Rav Soloveitchik, Zichron Levracha, was talking about, I think it was his father or his grandfather, each one of them was great, Rav Chaim, his grandfather, was the founder of the Briskian method, saying that he had this, when he taught something, when he gave a lesson, if he could say it in six words, he wouldn't say seven words, he would say it in six words. And if he didn't need six words, he would say it in five words. He was really very stringent about this point, not to waste words and to communicate with precision. He says, if however, to the contrary, that the words are many, abundant, and the significance, what he said, communicating is minimal, he says, I raise him sichlus. That's what he calls foolishness. Then he continues to warn about this, that it's offense. Siyogla chachma shesika. He says a person should not be in a hurry to answer when a question is asked. I right away have an answer. Think first. Think before you speak. And then he talks about teachers, that they should teach their students in a calm manner and not getting wild and screaming and that kind of thing, or not going too verbose. Then he says in Vav, Halacha Vav, this is Perek Beis, that it is prohibited for a person to conduct himself with words of smoothness, flattery. Flattery, smoothness. It's interesting. It doesn't say whether they're telling the truth or lying. It's a certain derech. You know, people are always flattering and that type of thing. And a person should not be one way with the mouth and one way in the heart. That's
a real expression for that.
Divrei chalakos. Chalakos. Upitui. Pitui is a seduction, but to seduce people with words. All of these character traits are highly prized in this society. That's the one who gets ahead, the person that has these social abilities. And That's why the brothers, even when they were criticized and they couldn't speak peacefully, they couldn't speak peacefully with Yosef, but Rashi says that that's they're praiseworthy for that, even though they were wrong for hating him. But once they hated him, they didn't seek to create the impression that they were friendly with him. They were at one. This is just the way they felt, that's the way they acted. Then he says that it's prohibited to be gonev das. Gnevas das is theft. Theft of a person's knowledge, of their mind, so to speak.
Plagiarism.
To deceive. Well, plagiarism is not, that's not what he's talking about. That's a separate thing. That's actual gneva. But this is something where deceiving a person, giving a person a false impression, that's called gnevas das. He says even the das of a nachri. He gives examples of a Gentile. How so? For example, let's say you're a butcher and you have kosher meat, but let's say by accident some of the meat got trafed up. So you don't want to get it's expensive and all of that, and you have Gentile customers that come to you. So you'll say, I'll sell the trafe to the Gentile because he doesn't have to keep kosher. Are you permitted to do that? You're not permitted to do that. Why? Unless you specify. Unless you tell them what the case is. Because since he's buying at a kosher place, for whatever reason, there are Gentiles that believe that kosher is better, higher quality, it's cleaner, whatever. They used to have those, it's for Hebrew National. We obey a higher authority.
We
answer to a higher authority.
It's a direct line of communication.
Yeah. Well, that's very effective. I don't know what to say. I'm sorry?
It isn't the truth.
Well, I'm not here to...
I'm advertising, it's false.
Well, what they mean by that is that they answer to the Torah, that the Torah is kosher now. That's what they mean. Let's leave it at that. Assuming that it's the truth, I'm not questioning that, but it seemed to me to be an effective advertising. That's how it affects me, because most people give a certain aura that since you're obedient and you're religious and you're following it, therefore we can assume that everything else is kosher. It's kosher down law. But anyways, the Rambam is saying that you're not permitted to sell him the treif meat with the appearance that it's kosher. Unless you're obviously, if you tell him what their reality, you tell him that this meat I have actually is not kosher. I can't sell it to a Jew if you want it. And he accepts it, or you give him a lower price, whatever it is, then it would be different. But to just do it, that's Gnevas Das. And the Rambam has not made a differentiation between a Jew and a Gentile, any Gnevas Das. You see, therefore, that it's not just a question of hurting the other person, which you are hurting the other person. That is, a person is entitled to the truth. All things being equal, it's something that you owe to another individual not to mislead them.
Is there a fine distinction between shekel and...
The problem over here is that you're permitting the person to operate on the false premises. You're allowing. You're creating a false... It's creating a false impression. It's a false impression. But it's not a lie. And that's an interesting question. The Rambam has said that it's prohibited to create false impressions. That's a very significant thing. And it affects us in many ways. He says that you can't implore another person to invite him to please, you have to come like in shul, you pull somebody over and come eat with me on Friday night. You can't do that when you know that he already has a place to go. Are you lying? Yeah, that's false. You're creating the impression, you didn't know, you're inviting him. But you already know, the only reason you're inviting him, I mentioned that very often, when you send out invitations for a bar mitzvah or a wedding, so you have a limit, obviously. And there's always people on the second tier or third tier, depending on how many no's, refusals you get, then you start inviting them. They're not on the A-list. That's okay. Nothing wrong with that. That's fine. But let's say there's someone that didn't survive the cut. And then you find out that they're going to be in Israel that weekend. Word comes to you that they're going to be in Israel. So then you send them, are you allowed to send them an invitation? When the only reason that you're sending the invitation is because you know that they cannot come. Now, how many people would object to that? Would think there's anything wrong? People would say, that's terrific. Unbelievable. I'll send the invitation and no problem. You're not permitted to invite a person under those circumstances, because you're creating a false impression. That's Gnevas Das. You're giving him the impression that he's on the list of people that should be invited. And he's going to act on that basis. For example, he may send a gift, which really raises a question of whether you're entitled to keep that gift. I'm not saying it's outright theft, but it's deception. Deception which is resulting in, had this person known that they're not invited, then they're not invited. The reality, the truth is that they're not invited. This is a phony invitation. It's counterfeit. So they would not send the gift. And because of this lie, this falsification, they're going to send the gift, so you're getting it on false pretenses. And he goes on, the Rambam goes on, and says that, again, we're offering a person a gift when you know that he's not going to accept it. All those kinds of phony behaviors. Or he even says about someone that is a wine seller, a wine merchant, and he has a guest. And he has to open up this cask of wine anyways to sell it. But he chooses to do so now to pretend that he's doing it in his honor, when in fact he knows that it's not. All this is deception. And that, by the way, concerning these things, the Torah says that, and you shall fear the Lord your God. The Rashi points that out, that there are many, many occasions, mitzvos, averos, sins, where the Torah attaches, and you shall fear the Lord your God. Or ani Hashem, I am the Lord. Rashi says, because these things are given over to the heart. There's a category of laws that are given over to the heart. That is, it all depends upon, there's no extraneous factor that's going to restrain you. Telling a lie, there are extraneous factors you have to be concerned you might get caught. Theft, you have to deal with the fact it's not only dependent upon your heart, you know, there's dangers out there. But these are the kind of things that it's dependent upon your heart. There's no danger, only you know the truth. Only you know. How's anyone going to find out? You open them up, oh, you hear, you're a guest, let's open up this kiss in your honor. Yeah, there's no way he could ever prove that you were going to open it up anyways, because Monday morning you're going to be selling it. There's no way that can be proved. So it's only known to you in your heart. So this is the test of your heart. So then he says even one word of pitui, which is flattery, as we mentioned before, or gnevas das, an important term to remember, theft of a person's knowledge, that is by creating a false impression. But he says, elisfas emes, lips of truth, and a ruach nochon, a correct, accurate, a spirit, v'lev tor, pure heart, and so on. This is extremely important. That's step number one. I wanted to give you a sense of how seriously the Torah considers lying. And when he says even one word, I think this should disabuse us of the notion that, you know, small lies, whatever, it's not that big. There's no such thing as a small injustice, let's put it that way. However, you do find, you're all aware of the fact, you do find that there are cases where you do find lying in the Torah. The classical example is probably the case of Yaakov. Yaakov lied to his father when he said, Ani Esav Bechorecha, I am your Bechor, your firstborn Esav. So he lied. I know that there's a Rashi over there, that Rashi sort of tries to give the impression at face value that no, he wasn't Ani, I am who I am. Of course, if you put the commas, you readjust the commas, Esav Bechorecha, Esav is your Bechor. Yes. Of course, obviously, Rashi didn't intend it to be taken that way. Rashi didn't intend to exonerate him from a lie. As is being pointed out, if you don't consider that a lie, you can't. First of all, you don't have that option. If somebody were to go into court and speak that way, mention three words in a row that constitute a lie, but then say, no, I meant it this way, by putting in the pauses, you could show that it's not a lie. This person is going to be a liar. No one's going to buy that. That's a lie. And of course, he's creating a false impression. What's the difference? Is it better to lie in a manner that's more clever, that somehow or other you could misconstrue, you could reconstitute the meaning of the words? Does that make it any better? That's a falsification. That's not what Rashi means. I'll try and explain. But of course, the really troubling thing is, how could he lie? Now, there are cases where you're permitted to lie. I just want to go through some of them. This is the Gemara in Bava Metzia, the Talmud, says that in these three matters, the rabbis, rabbis were in the habit of not telling the truth. And this is the way you're supposed to act. You're not supposed to tell the cases where you're not supposed to tell the truth. One is b'masechet. Masechet means tractate. That is to say, according to the explanation of Rashi, if somebody asks you, are you a master of this tractate of the Talmud? And the truth of the matter is that you are. You're supposed to say no. You're supposed to say no. Now, there's another. I can't go through all the discussion. Of course, there's another Gemara that says that you're supposed to acknowledge that you are. But Tosus explains. It all depends. If the reason why the person is asking is because there's an issue that has arisen and they need your guidance, so then you're supposed to say the truth. But if there's no necessity, no practical necessity, just a matter of curiosity, then you're supposed to demur and say you don't know. No, you're not. And Rashi says, why? Because of anivus. Because of humbleness. A person's supposed to be humbleness. Then it says, uvapurya. That's an expression relating to sexual matters. That if a Talmud Chacham was asked whether the person has, it doesn't say why a person would ask him, but whatever, there must be a certain baseness if he's fulfilled his sexual responsibilities. He's supposed to say no, because of that's a matter of tzniyus, of modesty. So you see that in certain situations the obligation to be truthful is superseded by other considerations. Then, interestingly enough, uva ushpiza. Ushpiza, yeah, you know that word from Sukkos. Ushpizen, the guests. If you're a guest, let me just quote it from Rashi. If he's a person like he's a businessman, he travels, let's say you're going somewhere and there aren't any Jews around, except for one person, and he took you in, it's kosher, hospitality, and all of that. So, when you come back, if people ask you about this person, does he accept guests, does he feed them, and all of that, you're not allowed to tell the truth. You're supposed to, in fact, lie, because the danger is that you're going to cause a harm to this person, that people are going to pounce on him. Now, people are going to travel there, and they're going to go to his house, and you're going to embarrass him. He's not going to be able to feed them. You see? So these are the three things. In other Gemaras, there are other cases that I mentioned. If anyone's familiar with any of the other cases that I brought down, for example, at a wedding to be mesamech the chasen and the kala, well, this pertains more to the kala, to say how that she's beautiful, to tell the chasen, for example, what a beautiful kala and all of that. Now, even if you yourself don't think she's beautiful, so if you're going to be truthful, if you're going to be completely honest, you say I don't think she's, even if you have to say that she's ugly, if that's what you thought. No, the mitzvah, that's not a time for truth. This is not a time for truth. And you're supposed to praise her, she's a beautiful kala, and say nice things about her. And even if it's not just about her looks, in general, even if you don't think she's such a good person, this is not the time for the truth. And of course, there's the famous case, the case of Shalom Bias. And there you see even God, so to speak, is changing it around because of Shalom Bias. That's with regard to Sarah, because Sarah was rebuked that she said shall a woman of 90 bear children, and Vadoni Zaken, and my husband is very old. When Avram repeats that to Sarah, when God repeats that to Sarah, let me get it straight. When God repeats it to Avram, correct? So God omits. So why did Sarah say that that a woman is so old? But God omits the part where she also mentioned and the fact that my husband is old. That's also a problem in her mind. That God omits that. So Rashi points that they are shalom because of peace. Because to whatever extent that would disturb, perhaps would disturb Avram. So you see that for shalom bias also, in order to maintain shalom bias, it's permitted to, I guess you got to call it lying, not to be truthful, to create a false impression. Of course, everybody has to recognize, let me just, this doesn't mean to say that any lie in the world, obviously, So, essentially, I can't go into a definition now. We're not talking about serious lies that are more disruptive and so, you know, or things that the you're not allowed to lie about, obviously. But it means to say, with regard to trivial things. Can't lie about the finances if it's a serious situation and you got to know and that type of thing. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking here. I don't like to use the expression white lies because basically what I was saying is there are no white lies. But here I would make a distinction between two different types of lies. There's a lie where the result of this lie has to do with knowledge. With you can have a false idea about reality, significant. In this case, it's true from a technical standpoint. From a technical standpoint, you're not conforming to the truth, but it's not harming the person in any way. The fact that Avram didn't know that she also said that my husband is old, he doesn't need that knowledge. That knowledge is not of any significance. But is it a distortion? Yes, it's a distortion. But you're distorting in an area where it's not going to make any difference. That knowledge is not necessary to your general well-being. That's why I'm making a distinction between lying in a case where it is necessary and creating a false impression. I one time heard an explanation which covers these cases. And the explanation was with regard to the case of Yaakov lying. What was the justification? And the explanation, I believe it goes back, I'm not sure if I remember from who, I think it traces back to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, but I could be wrong on that. If so, it was a great scholar. Anyways, was that the Torah does not specifically prohibit lying per se, but the prohibition of lying derives from the obligation of, it's called Mahu Afata, to emulate the ways of God, to get closer and closer to God. Just as he is called compassionate, so too you should be compassionate. And that's the basis for all of our obligations in terms of virtues, in terms of behaviors. So, Hashem Hashem, all the 13 attributes, Kael Racham, Vachanan, that God is merciful. So why do I have to be merciful? And there's no specific command to be merciful, but you're supposed to imitate, imitate God to the best of your ability, and you can't really imitate God, but just the ways that God has revealed to us. That's the perfection of our souls, to be more godlike. So it's chesed ve'emes. There's compassion, but there's also emes. So that's why you have to be truthful, because being truthful is walking in the derech Hashem, in the way of God. However, what if there's a conflict between the various obligations? Sometimes you can't have chesed and emes at the same time. Sometimes the MS is not chesed. Sometimes the truth is not compassionate. So that's where you have the basis. That the Torah, when you go to these Gemaras, you'll see that the obligation in this situation, for example, tzniyus of modesty, means you don't speak about sexual matters. That's private. That's personal. You don't answer those questions. That overrides. And again, it's not in an area where the knowledge is of any importance in terms of objective truth. With regard to chesed. In this case, you don't give away the information that somebody was kind to you, and if you tell other people, they'll wipe them out. So the obligation of chesed and hakaras hatov overrides the obligation of emes in this case. And again, bear in mind that the emes factor over here is with regard to what I have called white lies that aren't really, but the information is not of any importance in terms of a person's need to gain truth. In the case of Yaakov, this is the explanation that was given, which I think is a brilliant explanation. What about if the lie that you're saying is really essential to preserve the truth? Because what's wrong with lying? The problem with lying is that it's a deviation from truth. Now, in this case, if he would have told, you see, what he was doing was lying in order to rescue a truth. In order to rescue the truth. That is to say, that the situation was that if Esav would have got the brachos, that would have been a lie. That would be saying, in effect, endorsing Esav as being a tzaddik, as being a righteous person. That would be the biggest lie. So in terms of truth, you see, where would there be a greater damage to truth? If Esav would get the brachos, or if he would not get the brachos, and Yaakov would have to lie and say that he's Esav. So he said, in this situation, the very demand of truth, the need for truth itself demands that he make this a lie, that he make this change, so to speak. Now, I think we can understand Rashi, though. What Rashi means when Rashi says that Anochi, when he was saying it, he was saying it in this way. I, Anochi, I, Esav is your firstborn. Rashi doesn't mean to say that therefore he wasn't lying. He had to tell a lie. There are times in your life when you have to tell a lie, obviously. If someone is a thief and he wants to know where somebody's house is, you're not allowed to tell him the truth. It's a mistake of directing. You tell him to go somewhere else. You do lie. In that case, you have to lie. But there's always a danger when you're telling a lie. This is what I mentioned before. And the danger is that to whatever extent there's a certain enjoyment within a person of being able to manipulate reality through not being truthful. And there's a danger that you might partake of some enjoyment. I fooled him. Children have that emotion, to be able to fool somebody else. So what Rashi is pointing out is that psychologically speaking, even though he was telling the lie, but in his own mind, he was preventing himself, he was guarding himself psychologically not to derive any emotional gratification from the telling of the lie. That, I believe, is the interpretation. Now, I want to go from here one more idea. This is what the Mashiach is leading up to. As we've said, you really can't, you're not allowed to lie, except for these rare situations that the Gemara has talked about. And again, essentially we're talking about white lies, where it doesn't really matter in terms of objective truth. Are you allowed to lie to a person to be makariv them to Judaism? Can you distort? Are you permitted to distort Judaism in order to make... There are many things you can tell. If you put up a mezuzah, then your house will never... No harm will come to your house, and there's no dangers, you don't have to worry, it'll be secure, and so on. Things which are not true. If you daven three times a day and do such and such and so forth, then you'll always be healthy and you'll be prosperous in business. And obviously there's truth in these things, but many people understand it in a different kind of a way, that it's like a magical potion, so to speak. Or any type of a lie to distort Judaism in order to make it pleasant for people. Obviously, you're supposed to make Judaism pleasant, but by explaining the ideas in the most sensible way. You're not allowed to distort the Torah. Interestingly enough, Christianity holds out this differently. I don't have the time to read through the quotes. If anyone's interested, there's a book called Their Hollow Inheritance, in which they have what's known as the pious fraud. And there's quotes from all over the New Testament to the extent, perhaps I'll quote one of them. This is in Corinthians. But if through my falsehood God's truthfulness abounds to his glory, why am I still being condemned as a sinner? And why not do evil that good may come, as some people slanderously charge us with saying? Their condemnation is just. And this is another one. To the Jews, I, that's Paul, this is Paul speaking, became a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law, that means the halacha, I became as one under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. And so on and so forth. Basically extolling the fact that he would do anything and say anything in order to win people over to Christianity. In Christianity, it's a completely different picture, because it's not founded upon truth. The perfection of a person is not in terms of yidia, in terms of knowledge, it's faith. So really, they don't care what avenue, so to speak. That's why these religions that have this idea, that essentially the person's salvation is dependent upon having a certain faith, whether it's rational, whether it makes sense or not. So then I can understand that, what difference does it make, as long as you got the person to a state of faith. But Judaism does not hold that way, because to the contrary, in Judaism the whole essence of perfection is the MS, is the truth. Now I wanted to raise this question. This question came to mind. Hillel. Was Hillel engaging in what might be called a certain type of a deception? There's the famous story about Hillel. A Gentile once came before Shammai and said to him, quote, that make me a ger, a convert, I'll become. In other words, he said, I'll become a convert on the condition that you teach me the entire Torah while I'm standing on one foot. Everybody's heard the story. So Shammai pushed him away with the builder's ruler he was holding in his hand. Let it get out of here. There's no such thing. Like, you want to study? You can study, but I can't give you a formula like that. Everybody always thinks that Shammai was a tough guy, was a mean guy, and Hillel was the nice guy. That interpretation is not true. The Gentile then went to Hillel, who accepted him. He said to him, "Well, yeah, fine. Get on one foot, and I'll tell you the." I'm just putting these words in, but that's basically what he was doing. Get on one foot, and I'll tell you what the fundamental rule of the Torah is: do not do others what you do not want done to yourself. That is the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn it. So basically, he was successful. This person became a convert. But is this really true? This is basically a form of the Ahaflarecha Kamocha. This is the golden rule. And you shall love your friend as yourself. Which means don't do to someone else that which you wouldn't want done to yourself. Now, of course, the question is, this is part of the Torah. But would you say that this is the essence of all of the Torah? This is the whole Torah? It's an aspect of Torah. It's essentially, the Rambam differentiates between two parts of the Torah. Mitzvos, which have to do with a person's personal perfection, like Ben Adam, Lamakam, between man and God. Knowledge of God, rejection, repudiation of idolatry, the keeping of the Shabbos, the keeping of the laws governing sexual behavior, kosher. These things are vital foundations of Torah. And then you have the second category, governing relations between man and man. The Rambam says that those laws of the Torah that pertain to a person's personal perfection, bring him closer to God, the love of God, Ahavat Hashem, love of God, and so forth, are on a higher level. Because he says the others are essentially based upon the fact that you're living in a society. So people have to have an orderly form of social relations. Here he's taking something which is, and you shall love, essentially, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. It's important, but you tell me that's the whole Torah. And in point of fact, there are interesting consequences to this, because you've had many, many reform movements that base themselves on this. Yeah, this is the whole Torah. That point was once made by a great scholar that, in a sense, on a certain level, this statement did have certain negative consequences in Jewish history, because groups did emerge, and I would say perhaps today, some segments of the Reform movement that want to just remove all of them and there's no need for the mitzvahs, because Hillel said that don't do all others, as long as you're being kind to others. Moral and ethical treatment of others, that's the essence, ethical Judaism. And they superficially you could have a foundation over here. So that's the question that I wanted to pose. And what did Hillel mean? Is this the truth? If it's not the truth, are you allowed to do this? If you know, if people ask you, would I be permitted to do this? Now, I know that people, an audience of people that are really, that's what they really like, this ethical, compassionate, treatment of other people. And they ask me, what's Orthodox Judaism? And if I give them this kind of a pleasant answer, then they'll join. Am I permitted to tell them and say, look, the whole thing is just be nice to your friend, that's all, you don't have to worry about anything else. And as a result of that, they're going to become, well, they couldn't be Orthodox for long, but they'd go along with me. No, that's a lie. I have to tell them Shabbos. I have to tell them that Tefillah and so forth. Now, in I'd like to give an explanation. In order to understand this, we really have to ask a question about the concept of the Ahavta Recha Kamocha. And many people have asked this question: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. How is this possible? We're talking about neighbor over here. Neighbor is not a good translation. It means a friend, and friend means a fellow Jew, which means that the person is a total stranger. So how is it possible? First of all, how can you be commanded to love anybody? That doesn't seem to be something which you can be commanded to do. And there's just so many people that a person can have love for in this world. You can't just say any stranger. Okay. And how, kamocha, like yourself, as you love yourself, that seems to be impossible. But the Rambam says that it doesn't mean the emotion, that you have to have an emotional love for every Jew, but it means you have to treat that person the way you would want to be treated. That is, just like you're concerned about your property, so too you should show the same concern for somebody else's property. No different whatsoever. I mentioned how many times you see this. Parents complain about kids that don't they leave the lights on. They don't take care of things around the house and so on and so forth. Yeah, but then you see these very same children when they get up, they grow older, or they get an apartment of their own, or they get married. All of a sudden, you see now they start to go around. See, when you have to pay the electric bills, then you notice. Suddenly, it's a problem. And if somebody forgets to put out a light, what's the matter with you? Can't you just put out the light? It's expensive. It costs money. Oh, yeah, well, how come it didn't cost money when you were leaving the lights on in your room when you lived at home? It's the same amount of money. Oh, that's different. You see, that's if a person acts that way, that is, when you're in somebody else's house, let's say they lend you their place or whatever it is, and you don't show the same consideration that you would want shown in your house, that's a violation of the Haftarah Kamocha. See, I maintain even that if you go to a hotel, are you permitted? There are people, when they go to a hotel, they pay for the room, so they leave the air conditioner, they go out for the day, they leave the air conditioner on all day, even though it's a waste of money, and they leave the light at night, they leave all the lights on, that's it, because I'm paying for it. Is that really permitted according to the Torah? I would say there are two problems over here. It's true, technically speaking, you pay for it, they can't stop you, because that's the rules. But you still, first of all, there's an issue of baltashkos, you're destroying property, you're wasting money. It's all being wasted. That's one thing. Secondly, what about the Haftar Ech Kamocha? Would you want to be treated that way? If you rented a room to someone, so it's true, you have a right, if you're going to use it. But if you're not, all I'm asking you to put out, would you want your property treated that way? That's what it means. So now, the question is, what is the basis? What is the basis of this ruling? Now, I maintain that Judaism has an interesting idea when it comes to the issue of human rights. You see, I maintain that there is no concept of human rights if you don't believe in a creator. People that deny God, if a person is an atheist, there are many people that consider they're atheists, but they're ethical in the terms of treatment. Yeah, but if there's no creator, so then everything exists purely by accident. There's no rhyme or reason. That's what you're saying. It just came into being by accident. So what is the source of your rights? Where do you get a right to live? What gives you a right to live? What do I have to respect you for? On what basis? You're just something that's out there. I'm out there and you're out there. And if you're in my way, I can get rid of you. What's the immorality of it? What am I violating? What is the source of your rights? See, I maintain that the founders of the framers of the Constitution understood this point. The Constitution says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. What comes next? That they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. They maintain that people have rights, but if there's a creator, that's the source of your existence. He gives you life, and it's his will that you should live, so then you have a right. I'm violating the will of the creator. I have to treat you. Then you have rights. But if there's no creator and you're an accident, so where does your rights come from? It doesn't make sense. It's absurd. That's the source of the mitzvah of the Haftar Ech Kamocha, in my opinion. That is to say, if a person does not recognize the Creator and have Ahavas Hashem, a love of God, then he can't fulfill it. It means like this: as you love yourself, that is, you're concerned about yourself. You want your kavo, your honor, to be respected. You want your property to be respected. Yeah, but what's the basis? Why? Because you're special? Because you're unique? That doesn't make sense. You do have rights. You are entitled to be protected, to be respected. Why? Because the will, God's will, relates to your existence. It's God's will that you should be able to exist in a certain kind of a way. That's why you have rights. That's why you're entitled. That's why you can demand that your property should be restored to you, and so on and so forth. Even if that's the basis, if the basis is the fact that I am created by a higher being, and that being has given me rights, then the very saying applies to your friend. There's no difference between your right and his right, because it all stems from the same source. Ah, so if my demand for rights is based upon the fact that I regard myself as a creature who was created by God for a certain purpose, so then I'm going to respect that with regard to all those creatures. There's no difference between me and anybody else who was created in his image. You have the same rights that I have, identical. I have to treat you the way I want myself to be treated. That's what I believe that Hillel was communicating to him. That the foundations of Judaism, he was communicating, are truthful. This we see expressed by Avraham Avinu. That Avraham Avinu practiced two things. There were two foundations. His love of God. He taught all of mankind about God. And it was based upon what? It was based upon his compassion. Truth. He discovered the truth, repudiated idolatry, discovered the true idea of God. And then why did he go about teaching all of mankind? Because that was the service of God. He realized that just like God created him, and it was God's will that he should perfect himself through this truth, so too it's God's will that all those other beings that he created should be perfected through this truth. So he was involved in doing the will of God with regard to himself and with regard to all creatures. Those are the two components. So you shall love your friend together, or do not that which is painful to you, don't do unto others. The foundation of that is the idea of Judaism, that the person's basic task in this life is to come to a recognition of God, of the Creator, and a love of the Creator. And once a person achieves that, that is the element which perfects all of his relations with other people. Those are the two foundations. Then the rest, of course, is footnotes. The mitzvahs, every mitzvah that you do will fall into one of the two categories. Either it will fall into the category of perfecting you in terms of your Yedias Hashem, your knowledge of God, as the Rambam says, or it will come into the category of perfecting your relationships with other people. If you find somebody's lost object, you have to take it in, you have to search for him, and you're not allowed to afflict the person with even verbally, and so on and so forth. That's what he meant. The rest is commentary. So my answer is that Hillel was telling the truth. That there was not, he was not making some type of a fraud, however pious, in order to win people over. He was communicating to him in the briefest fashion the underlying foundation. Yes, I can give you the foundations of Torah. The knowledge and love of God and the perfection of your relationship on that basis with other people.